your only obligation in any lifetime is to be true to yourself. Being true to anyone else or anything else is not only impossible, but the mark of a fake messiah. The simplest questions are the most profound. Where were you born? Where is your home? Where are you going? What are you doing? Think about these once in a while and watch your answers change. That is a quote from the Messiah's Handbook, Reminders for the Advanced Soul. It's fortune. That's what you get. You never know what you get. So in this episode, we're going to talk about lots of cool new technologies. And one of them, right off the bat, are new formats. Some new formats are coming out that I thought I should just mention, just because I can. One of them is the Open Raster format. I mean, I don't know how exactly new this is, but I had not heard of it before. And I kind of stumbled across it because when I was saving an application, a file out of, I think it was Krita or maybe GIMP, I don't remember. It was some application with graphics. I saw this as an option. It was Open Raster format, I think. O-R-A, maybe? I don't know. But it's a freedesktop.org initiative, as far as I can tell, because if you go to freedesktop.org/wiki/specifications with a capital S, Open Raster with a capital O and a capital R, then you'll see information on this. And the idea is that it's a new open format for multi-layered graphic files. Now, the first thing I asked when I saw that, when I was reading about it, was what's wrong with XCF? XCF is, of course, the GIMP format by default. And, I mean, you think if it's good enough for GIMP, it ought to be good enough for everything else. But apparently, that's not the case. And apparently, the GIMP devs say so. So it's not like Open Raster is ignoring, current technology and slighting the GIMP devs at all. It's apparently unanimous that a more generic open format for multi-layered graphic stuff should exist. And so Open Raster is the answer to that. So keep an eye on that. It might start popping up in various places. Another one is the opengex.org. That is OpenGEX is the format. And that's an interesting one. It's an open exchange format for 3D applications. Initially, there were two formats, if I'm correct, that were kind of going for that to occupy that, to answer that need. And one was Collada. I'm probably saying that wrong. And the other is just a .obj file. .obj generally is that's like the default, I have a 3D mesh here, I need to export it to some other 3D application, I'll just make it an .obj. But that's all it does. I mean, it's a pretty limited format, really. I haven't really looked into the specs, but I mean, it's got a lot of limitations in compared to what a 3D application is typically capable of. A .obj is a pretty limited file format. Collada or whatever it is, that one is a lot more full-featured, but apparently it has problems. Like, people aren't loving it for everything. It's not as universal and as complete as I guess it originally was intended to be. So OpenGEX is hoping to fill that need and that niche by offering a full-featured file format that can save all the different kinds of data that you would need in a 3D model. So once again, really, really exciting, kind of promising technologies that you should probably just kind of keep an eye on. And the OpenGEX.org site, you can compare like OpenGEX with the Collada format, so you can kind of see the advantages and disadvantages there. I think it'd be really cool if someone would finally come out with, and I no clue how easy or hard or impossible this would be. But like an open format for open spec for video editing files, I think that would be neat. And I realize that video editing software, I mean, it's really pretty, like, you've got completely different models and completely different software and technology contributing to all this stuff. But I mean, like, at a very abstract level, and maybe it would be too abstract, but at a very abstract level, there's really only so much you can be doing with video, you know? I mean, there's the compositing stuff, there's the transitioning kinds of stuff, there's color, you know? I mean, it's stuff that you can name, you know? You know what's going on. It's just what exactly the call out to the system is. Like, maybe one thing is calling MLT or FFmpeg, and something else is calling QuickTime. Something else is calling whatever the engine behind Avid is. You know, I mean, it's just different technologies are actually performing the work, but the work is definable. Again, I have no idea how hard that is. I mean, and certainly in closed source with their track record of actually enabling open standards, probably not going to happen. But it's, you know, just something that came to my mind. Okay, so those are open formats. Just thought I'd let you know about them. They're exciting. Keep an eye on them. Be aware of them. Fairly recently, I did a Hacker Public Radio episode on Docker. Docker is a very cool technology. It's Linux containers, which really probably doesn't mean anything to you unless you know about BSD containers. And if you don't really worry about it. Just pretend like it's a virtual machine without the virtual machine. Or rather, it's because, I mean, when you think of a virtual machine, what do you think of? You think of something in a, it's a screen that appears in your screen, and it's running inside of like this box. Maybe it's a virtual box, or maybe it's QEMU, or maybe it's one of the proprietary ones. So, well, virtual box I think is semi-proprietary. Anyway, point being, you know, it's like that. It's you know, you launch an application, and then you've got these virtual machines inside of this runtime. And then you launch it, and it's inside of that runtime. And a lot of times you can't even talk between your operating system and that operating system. You know, it's very, very, I'm trying not to say the word container because, you know, it's a runtime kind of environment, if you could think of it that way. Docker and Linux containers, if you can kind of imagine just removing that host application, you get rid of that and just put another application inside of your, I mean, put another operating system inside of your operating system. And it'll be running, and in theory, it'll be guarded from everything outside, and everything outside will be guarded from it, and it's a container. And it's running off of your kernel, and it's reusing a lot of your libraries. It does a lot of these really cool things, but it's own little environment. So that's more or less what a Linux container is. And Docker is kind of the front end to make that usable by normal human beings. I tried using Linux containers before, just raw, like LXC stuff or whatever. Really hard. I could not figure it out. It made no sense. Docker, you just fire it up. It's just done. You're done. You have images. You have operating systems. Very, very cool. And one of the neat things that are coming out just recently is called, it's called Docker Hub. And if you go to hub.docker.com/account/sign-up, you can sign up for it. And then you have access to all of these kind of ready-to-use, I dare say, turnkey Linux-like images, you know, so you've got all of these things that are kind of already set up to go. You download them, you initiate them with Docker, and you've got like these full-featured containers with all the things that you need already there, and they're kind of pre-configured and just kind of ready to go. I think it's very promising, and it's definitely something that you might want to look at if you're interested in this stuff. And it might be even worth looking at together. So let's do that.
Right, so what is Docker? Well, actually, let's back up for a minute and talk about where Docker comes from. So Docker is actually a sort of a front end, if you will, to something called Linux containers, which is governed by the lxc command, pretty much. I guess lxc is the interface to Linux containers. And Linux containers is something that got pushed into the mainstream Linux kernel not too long ago. And it's a way to, and I don't know all the specifics, so I'm not going to pretend like I do, but it is a way to essentially build little tiny system-alikes within a little cheruted environment, or similar to that, anyway, within your own system. So that might make even more sense the more we do it. So the less I speak and the more we do. So let's go full screen-ish, and let's get rid of that. Okay, so there is a command called lxc create. So lxc create, the syntax for this command is pretty much lxc create and then dash in, which is the name of your container file, and then dash t for the template that you want to use. So the templates are, as you would probably guess, are stored in /usr/share/lxc/templates. These are a bunch of templates that come along with lxc, the set of tools, and it's kind of neat because you can look at a template. Let's look at the lxc-fedora template. And sure enough, it's a plain text file. So yes, believe it or not, this is really all you need to build sort of a miniature little nested Linux system inside of the box that you already are running. And it seems pretty logical. Like, if you look at it, it's kind of like, okay, so it's going to create some kind of root file system. And then it's going to put all the typical directories that you would expect to see on whatever system you're building. So see here, you've got in this template file dev path equals rootfs path /dev. So that's where the devices are going to go. And you see a whole list here of device path, whatever that device path is, null, zero, random, urandom, SHM, you know, TTY, all of these things should sound or look very familiar to you, and that's basically what it does. Here again, touch rootfs path /etc/fstab, you know. So it's like, looking at the plain text file, you just think, oh, I totally see how this is actually possible. That's great. Now, I'm not going to tell you what's about to happen, but there's a hint of what's going to happen on screen. And if you're just listening to this episode, then no hints for you. But let's go ahead and try this. So we're going to say lxc-create-in. We'll call it Fedora lxc, _lxc. Dash t for the template, and we don't have to give it the full path because it knows where the path is. So we'll just say, yeah, we're going to use Fedora. Okay, and so I'm going to hit return. Oh, and I have to do that as root. That's okay, I can do that. So I'll do that again, lxc-create-in Fedora lxc-t Fedora. And it says that no config file was specified. That's okay, using the default config from /etc/lxc/default.conf. That's fine. But the problem is, and this is what was kind of on screen, is that there's a missing command, and the missing command is yum. And so you have to install yum, and of course it's kind of humorous here because they assume that you're on Debian for some reason, and they say you should do a sudo apt-get install yum. I don't want to do that. All right, well, maybe we could try something else. So let's try the same thing. And instead of using the Fedora template, we use the Ubuntu one. And same kind of issue, the deb bootstrap command is missing. Now I could do a find in my ports, my Slack builds folder, and see if there is a deb bootstrap. And actually there is. So this is something that I could actually install. I could probably get this to work. Yeah, deb bootstrap is used to create a Debian base system from scratch without requiring the availability of dpkg or apt. It does this by downloading .deb files from a mirror site and carefully unpacking them into a directory, which can eventually be chrooted into. So it sounds sounds pretty reasonable. So I could do that. I'm not going to right now because that's not really the point of what we're doing. I'm really more just trying to show you sort of what's involved with LXC, and hopefully you're getting the idea that that quite frequently there's stuff like there's dependencies essentially, and a lot of the things that you have to figure out are not figured out for you. This time I just tried an Arch Linux build and it says network link interface does not exist. So there's a whole bunch of things that you have to consider with LXCE, and that is the exact reason that they came out with Docker. So let's launch Firefox really quick and take a look at this hub.docker.com. So hub.docker.com, as I was telling you, is kind of a repository of not LXC templates, but the slightly or maybe more, maybe very more robust Docker templates, sort of, or Docker images, really. And I mean, it's not, you know, it's not one of those things that I can scroll forever. You know, it's a fairly small collection that they have so far. These are official repositories on hub.docker.com, but they're definitely formidable. You've got a, you know, the old standbys. You've got CentOS and Ubuntu, and then you've got like these Node.js, WordPress, MongoDB, MySQL, Nginx, Postgres, and I don't know what this is. Redis. So I'm going to click on the CentOS one, and it gives you some information about the repository, and you kind of have a look around, and it gives a little bit of an example here, and the main idea is that you need to get the repository. It's very similar, obviously, to sort of a package manager. Really, it's kind of the same, if you think about it, the same, more or less the same workflow. I typically just make Docker aware that it exists. And the way that you do that is you pull the name of the repository. And the name of the repository is, you know, generally broadcasted fairly well throughout hub.docker.com. Well, first of all, I should introduce the idea that the way that I got Docker was I installed it. Not that big of a deal. It was just in my Slack builds tree. It would be in your package manager if you're not using Slackware. You know, it's a little extra application that you install. The difference is that it's, as far as I know, the only way to use it right now is through the shell. So don't go looking in your menu for Docker. It's not there. So I don't think it is. No, it's not. So that's where you get Docker if you don't already have it. It does rely on a couple of oddball things like BTRFS, ButterFS, whatever, BetterFS, and some other things. But yeah, it's a pretty simple install. So once you have it, then you can kind of run it and see what's up. Now, the one thing that you do need for it to do is be running as a daemon in the background. I don't use Docker on an everyday basis by any means, so I don't have it just starting at boot time. I really don't need it. So I mean, I mess around with it, but I don't actually like use it for real. So I am just starting it in the background right now with Docker space dash D as in daemon. I generally pull the information for the entire repository. And now that I have the repository, I can say Docker, I think just images. Yeah. So that's a little bit unwieldy for this screen, but for those of you who aren't watching, you don't have to suffer through it. So Docker images will list all of the images that Docker kind of like knows about right now. It's not on your machine. It's just the repository that you can pull from. So since this is a live kind of deal, this busy box image is looking really good to me. And so let's say, because it's 2.4 megabytes, anyone who's just listening doesn't see why I'm saying that, but now I'm telling you, busy box is 2.4 megabytes. It's kind of nice. So I'm going to just say Docker pool busy box. Docker images, blah blah blah. So this busy box image is looking pretty good to me. So let's do a Docker pull busy box. So it's found the default image of busy box, which is the latest image. It's found the little hash of this image. It all sort of seems to add up. We're going to run a command in this container that we have. I should do Docker space run. So if I just do a Docker run, then it kind of tells me sort of more information. The thing that I want to do is make it an interactive shell or an interactive session, and I want to use a sudo tty. So what we'll do is we'll do a Docker run dash I for interactive, dash T for the tty session, and then of course it's a busy box container, the busy box image that we want. And then I think I can define which shell we should use. I'm not sure if I have to or not. Let's look. I'm pretty sure I should. Well, we'll find out. Okay, and as you can see, we've got a little new prompt here that looks a little bit different than maybe what we're used to. It's a forward slash and then a hash or a pound, whatever, and Octothorpe. And let's do something crazy like uname. It's Linux, okay. Uname dash av. Okay, so this is kind of interesting because you see, well, maybe it's not that interesting to you because you probably don't know what it should look like. So let me grab another terminal really quick here, and this is Slackware. So here's the current uname dash av. It's Linux 3.10.17, AMD FX 6300 6 core processor. So that's what that looks like, okay? Now we're looking at this busy inside of this prompt, which is busy box Linux 227FA48C8C6C14 3.10.17. So same kernel version and everything, but you can see that the name of the kernel is different. And certainly what it's reporting back is a little bit different. It knows it's a 64-bit processor, doesn't really tell me anything about the AMD-ness of it, and so on. So if I do an ls, you can see that we're at the root directory of really our fake BusyBox environment. For instance, if I say ls home, there's a default and an FTP. So again, if I bring up another terminal, which I guess I should just probably leave open, and do a list of home, you can see that there are actual users on this computer, whereas in this little tiny environment, it's really a lot less. So again, just kind of going through various folders, let's, for instance, say I've got a Z shell, whatever, a bunch of Z commands, you know, lots of things that you would normally expect on a, for instance, Slackware system, and on this one you've got more like, I don't know, a handful of commands, including the BusyBox command itself. So, yeah, no, the point here is that we're in a BusyBox container. We are obviously on Slackware, but we're also within BusyBox, and it's got its own little network set up here. For instance, my actual Ethernet address is not 127.17.0.2. It is something more like nothing, because I'm not hardwired right now. This is on wireless, so Ether is basically self-assigned or something. WLAN would be something. So yeah, it's kind of cool. This is a very different system than what I'm actually sitting in front of, and that's kind of neat. So there you go. That's Docker for you. And it's pretty simple to get started with, as you can see. It's really just a matter of Docker pull some image that you find online, or the entire repository if you prefer, whatever. And then Docker run -i -t and then some shell. And you can sit there interactively and kind of get familiar with the little embedded system. And obviously there's a lot of other stuff that you can do, including networking and stuff like that. So, yeah, have fun with that. I think it's pretty cool, pretty neat. There are still problems with it. You know, it's still early. It's not perfect technology, but it's definitely something to start messing around with, because it really is very cool. It's sharing so many of your resources with your system. Kind of nice.
So we should go get some coffee. Let's do that, and then we'll come back for more. More show, no, more coffee. Okay, I've got my coffee, you have yours. We should talk a little bit about mime types for all the noobs out there. Mime typing is an interesting issue, and it's generally speaking, it is how your computer interprets certain kinds of files. That's kind of what a mime type is. So the fact that your computer knows when you click on a .jpeg file, .jpg, or .jpeg, the fact that your computer knows how to open that or what to open it in, it's relying upon mime types. Because somewhere in your computer, there's something that says, hey, here's what you should do if the user tries to open up, you know, this kind of file. And Linux does this really, really intelligently, actually. Linux is it handles mime types probably the best of any operating system that I have ever experienced. It does it very, very intelligently. But you can always define your own mime types. And this is helpful because especially, I mean, with me at least, I'm always ending up with some kind of application, I mean, some kind of data type, some kind of file that the computer's just like, it's apparently never seen before. You know, I don't know if I just use enough weird applications or what. Maybe it's because I use Slackware. I'm supposed to do it all myself. I don't know. But I always, or I'm always very picky about certain things. You know, it's kind of like one of those things where, well, I mean, for instance, I think I said this in an earlier episode. I mean, M4A and MP3 and AUG, they're all the same thing, essentially. I would like for them to all open up in the same application. And for a very long time, I think it was maybe Aug Video that, like, every time I would open it, it would open up in, like, Firefox or something. It was really bizarre. It was right when Aug had gotten introduced as, you know, HTML5 video tags. Right after that, it seemed like every time I opened up an Aug Video, it would open up in a browser instead of, like, a video player. So little things like that, just, you know, they tend to sort of drive me crazy. But luckily on Linux, you can define, on other operating systems, you can sometimes override what application opens up a certain file type. You usually, like, right-click on it and tell it to always do such and such a thing. On Linux, there's a couple of different ways to do that as well. I mean, you can right-click on it and do that, but I'll show you all the different ways that you have available to you. And the nice thing about Linux, of course, is that there's always that way that you can kind of, you can do once and then port to all of your other computers, and it just, it makes everything, you know, you only have to do it once, and then it works for all of your other, your systems. So let's take a look at that.
So what about these MIME types? Well, let's take a look. So the concept is pretty simple. You could probably see in this little example folder here that I've created. For instance, I have three different kinds of video files. MP4, AUG, and WebM. All pretty darn good video formats, really. So to the normal user, they're all videos, right? That's what they are. You don't think of a file if you're a normal video, or if you're a normal user, or if you're in normal user mode. I mean, I think often about codecs because that's kind of part of the work that I'm in, really. But generally speaking, when I'm at home, I don't like to think of something. Well, actually, I do. But pretend like I don't usually like to think of something as an AUG or an WM or an MPEG-4. I just think, okay, it's video. I want to click on it and I want to have it play. So here's this talk from PyCon 2013 about something called Whoosh, and it is opening and it is playing, and it happens to be opening and playing in MPlayer. Cool. So that's a video file. It opened up in MPlayer. I like MPlayer, so I'm okay with this. So here's an AUG video, Screencasters, the Inkscape tutorials. And it's opening and playing just fine. But, I mean, you'll notice possibly that it has done so in KPlayer. And that's not a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with that. But you have to admit that if one time your video opens up in this interface, MPlayer interface with this little remote control kind of setup, you know, like the on-screen remote, and then it opens up the next time, or some other video file opens up in KPlayer with, like, all these sort of inline toolbar controls, and then a third time I open up this WebM, lo and behold, it's another video about technical stuff, GIMP, Python stuff, but it's opening in Firefox because, you know, whatever. WebM, it's an internet kind of video standard, so maybe it would do that. This is all made up, of course, but I mean, it's not so made up that it never happens. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you deal with if you've got three different video players on your system, and we all do, right? I mean, because there's the one that shipped with your distribution, and then there's the one that you actually use, which is either VLC or MPlayer, let's face it. So the problem here is that these file types, let me make this terminal a little bit larger, these file types are all, of course, deep down unique, and we can do that, we can look at that with the command file, and then the path to the file that you want to kind of look at. And so this Python whoosh.mp4 is indeed an IsoMedia MPEG-4 version 4 system, version 1. Okay, great. And then if we look at the AUG video, it'll tell us that it is an AUG data Theora file, and so on and so on. So our desktop is seeing these as three separate types of files, because more or less they are. So if we want them to open, if we want all media to open forever in the same video player, there are a couple of different ways to achieve that effect. Now the quick and dirty sort of fly by night kind of way is just to right-click on the file, usually, and select Other, or Open With, or some term like that. It'll depend on what desktop you're using, but I'm assuming you're using KDE on Slackware, because, I mean, why wouldn't you? And in this case, I can tell it, okay, I want you to, well, this actually does open in Player, so let me choose VLC. And I'll say OK to that, and it opens up in VLC, and it plays as expected, and it's nice and familiar, and we like it. But of course, if I go back and click on it again the next time, it'll forget all about VLC, and it opens back up in MPlayer, which is actually lately my preferred player anyway. But so that's not persistent. So if we want it to be persistent, we can right-click on it and choose Open With Other, and we can tell it, well, rather than opening in KPlayer, I want you to actually open it in Player. And here, right near the OK button, there's this little selection, Remember Application Association for this type of file. And again, depending on what interface you're using, your desktop, it might say something else, like remember this choice, or whatever. But the idea is, yes, we want to set all OGG files to open up in MPlayer. And that's what it's doing, so that's nice. And I would do the same thing, right-click, Open With Other, and I would find MPlayer in my list of applications, and I would tell it to remember, and I would click OK, and it updates my system config, and yes, look at that. It is now opening in MPlayer, and they do that every single time, as you can see. So that's how you can kind of forever and fairly easily reset the application that something will open in depending on what kind of file it is. And of course, it doesn't have to be these files. If I have another OGG file or another WM file or MP4 file, then if I click on them, they will open in MPlayer, and that's for sure. Okay, so the other way to do that is in System Settings, and this is kind of where there's a pretty big gap or differential, really, in how different desktops implement this kind of concept that I'm about to show you. KDE actually, in KDE fashion, gives you, I dare say, overkill. It's in the File Associations selection, the panel, and known types, you can look at application types, you can look at image types, you can look at, since we're doing video, we'll look at video types, and as you can see, there is listed here just about every type of video probably known to, well, MPlayer, certainly, since that's my default backend, but yeah, it's a lot of things, and you can go through every single selection and tell it to move MPlayer to the top of the preference list. So here's an MPEG, and it has Zine as the top selection, which I don't really want. I want it to be MPlayer. And I guess my second choice really would be VLC. So that's the order, and then Zine, and then Dragon Player, and then KPlayer. So that's kind of how you would do that in KDE, and that would work. But again, that's a lot of files to click through, really, and that can get pretty difficult to deal with if you're trying to set consistent applications across the board. In GNOME and Cinnamon, and probably Mate or Mate, however you say that one, if you go to Default Applications, you will find that they have about 5 different selections, and you're not seeing it on my screen, so that's how audio listeners feel. You'll just have to imagine it. There's about 5 different selections, and, you know, yeah, one might be, like, Internet, and one is, I think, Mail, and one is the File Manager, I think. But the other ones that aren't here in KDE that are there in these other desktops are video and audio files. And that's pretty handy, really, because you can just say, yes, if it is an audio file, if it if its MIME type starts with the word audio, then open it in VLC. And if it's a video, then open it in VLC. And that's kind of a nice feature. And I'm not aware of any kind of sort of blanket statement that you can make to your desktop in KDE that way. There are a lot of other choices for a lot of other things, but as far as I know, that's not one of them. So that's okay. I muddle by with making, you know, I just go through one time and tell it to remember how something is going to be open, and then it opens with that application pretty much forever. Now the place that goes to, like the changes that we just made in system settings or in the right click menu, is in your home folder /share/applications/mimeapps.list. So this is a really pretty complete list of all the custom choices that you have made on your system, if you've made any, and I have. So for instance, JPEG-2s, which are image/JP2 is the MIME type, gets open in GwenView. AUG, the audio AUG, gets opened in MPlayer. Audio MPEGs get opened in MPlayer. FLAC opens in MPlayer. I use MPlayer a lot, as you can tell. MP4, MPlayer, and then KPlayer, that's not really what I prefer, but whatever. Video, MPEG, MPlayer, and then VLC, and if you'll remember, that's exactly what we did in system settings. I made that change right there, just as you were looking, as you were watching it. It was really cool. And here's that WebM entry, actually. So as you can see, the first choice is now MPlayer, but that's because we did that in the right-click menu. And then the second choice is Mozilla Firefox, which was never even a choice, but just to throw things off, I added that before I started screen recording. That's why that's there. So that's where all this information is getting stored. They're added associations is what they're called. And again, that file location is /.local/share/applications/mimeapps.list. I don't think you're really meant to edit that by hand, although you may be able to. I'm not really sure. I've never done it that way. But certainly that's where those things get stored, which is handy because as long as you're taking your home folder around with you or saving your .dot files, then you know you inherit that MIME apps list on any computer that you use. And that becomes very useful because you literally only have to set it once, and then every other computer that you ever use on any regular basis, you just bring over that mimeapps.list and all of your configuration is loaded, you know, pretty much automatically. So that's pretty straightforward, but it gets a little bit more complex when the MIME types are actually the same. So here's the thing. A lot of times we kind of imagine, or I imagine that we imagine, that the last, those little last three or four letters at the end of a file name, we equate that with, like, you know, the type of file that it is. And typically desktop environments kind of agree with us and reinforce that notion, because if, for instance, I rename a .txt file as an MPEG-4, well, certainly my desktop preview believes me. It just takes it for granted that it's an MP4 and gives it that icon. And now if I click on it, it does attempt to open that text file in MPlayer, which is kind of silly. So we think of that suffix, oops, as the MIME type, but and while it is taken as an indicator of the MIME type in certain desktop environments and certainly in closed source desktop environments, I believe that's pretty much invariably the way that these things are handled. If I open this kwrite.txt one, it does open because it's set to do so in kwrite. That's great. But now this .scp also opens in kwrite, and that, while it looks fine, it's actually not what I wanted. the .scp extension is an extension that I personally use for screenplays that have been written in Emacs screenwriter mode. So I don't really want it to open in Kwrite, I want it to open in Emacs. So we know the answer to this, we think. We would open with, or right-click on it, open with, other, and then we would find wherever it's wherever they keep Emacs these days. It looks like it's in development. And I'll tell it to remember that for this type of file. It updates my system configuration, and it opens it in Emacs. So that's correct. But then look what happens if I write this, if I open this file that's meant for Kwrite. Oops, it opened it up in Emacs as well. So while Emacs is clearly the superior option here, it's really not what I want. If I want one file to open in Kwrite and I want the other to open in Emacs, and that doesn't seem like such a tall order, but to the computer it is, because I'm telling it, you know, two different things for the same kind of file. There's no differentiation there. It turns out that you can actually make your own MIME types. The way to do that is with this XDG utility set, which has a lot to do with the free desktop kind of specifications of what should open what. So now we need to create a little MIME type specification. So we'll just call it, let's call it mime-scp, and it's an XML file. So I've got a sample kind of already installed because it's just enough verbosity for me not to remember off the top of my head. So here's what we've got. Ignore these line numbers on the left. So the first line is the XML version. So that's the typical XML tag, you know, greater than or less than ? XML version equals 1.0 ? Close tag, not a big deal. And then MIME info XMLNS equals the link to the freedesktop.org standard for shared MIME info. The next tag is MIME type type, and that equals, and this is where it gets interesting, it's application / x-scp. And then the comment that we'll make in it is Emacs screenwriter file. And then the glob pattern, and obviously this is how everything kind of recognizes that as a as that, you know, as a MIME type, really. It's anything, or, you know, asterisk dot scp. And then you close the MIME type, which is this guy here, and then you close the MIME info, which brings us to a close. So I'll save that, I'll quit out of this, and now all we need to do is install this specification, which is just the xdg mime command, and we'll do an install of the screenplay, or I think we called it mime-scp.xml. So this is, you're seeing that I'm doing this as a regular user. I'm not root or anything. So this is all something that you can do for yourself without dropping into root or talking to your administrator or whatever, which is all kind of cool. So now, technically, I should have, as, you know, as a unique entity, this .scp. This should be a unique thing to my desktop. So I'll tell it to open all the .scps in Emacs, and then I'll tell it to open all the .txts in Kwrite, which you've already seen me do, or heard me do if you're only listening to this. And now we will have to log out. Okay, here we are back, logged back in, so all the settings have been scanned and restored and reloaded. And as you can see, possibly, the icon for my screenplay file has changed, but not to what, but if we single click on it, it doesn't happen to remember what I had set it to earlier. And that's obviously because when I had set it earlier, the fact that that mime type existed had not yet been a thing. So let's look now that we set it with a right click, open with. It opens in Emacs. That's nice. Let's see if this opens in Kwrite, and it does. So there you go. Not bad. The icon, the question of the icon, not too sure about that. I've never actually tried to give a mime type a special icon before. But you can see when I right-click and click properties, it does identify the type as Emacs screenwriter file, which is kind of cool. And you can see that you could click for more options, but we can choose any number of very suitable icons that already exist for this thing. I never use this one. This looks kind of cool, so I'll take a funky... Well, maybe that looks unprofessional. I'll take a nice looking document with a pen on it, and I'll say apply, and I'll probably need to close Dolphin and reopen it to try to get it to look at that file again, that file again. And then we'll go back into examples, and yeah, there you go. So this has changed the, if I click on, right click on it and go to properties and go to file type options, I can set the icon to pretty much whatever I please. I just now noticed the one that I chose is actually, I think, an OpenOffice icon possibly, so I don't really want that. And if you close your file manager and reopen it, it kind of looks at that file again and loads the correct icon. So now let's do something crazy, like rename our... Well, let's click on our file for Kwrite. That's opening in Kwrite correctly. My SCP file is opening in Emacs. That's great. And now if I right-click on my .txt file and... really, really risky. Let's change it to a .scp file. Well, it picked up the icon. That's nice. And if I click on it, it opens in Emacs, just as expected. So the same file, but completely different, a different result, which is fantastic. It's identifying as an ASCII text file. So it knows what kind of file, you know, it actually is. But because we've defined just on the basis of those last three letters, and we've given it a whole sequence of sort of free desktop specification linkages, it knows how to open that. And if we look into our mimeapps.list again, which was in home directory.local /share/applications/mimeapps.list, we should be able to find, yeah, here it is, our own little mime type. So there you go. That's mime types for you. It's very exciting stuff. It's very cool. It's kind of neat to see your own special mime type in existence. Obviously, I would probably want to hold on to my little XML file, my specification, and you know, any other settings that I have for this, maybe the commands that I had run for the XDG thing to work. But otherwise, yeah, it's not really that hard. It's really just, you know, what is that, like 8 lines of XML. So it's not that bad, a couple of commands. So yeah, that's how you make your own mime types for real.
Those are mime types. That's how you manage that on Linux. Again, not really difficult at all, and potentially very, very powerful. Kind of depends on how much effort you want to expend on making this always work a certain way on every computer that you have access to. That's probably the end of this show. So thank you for watching, and I will talk to you in 2 weeks for a lot more cool stuff. Promise.
Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as always. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or at SlackerMedia.info. You can find me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And you can also find me on linuxquestions.org as notklaatu. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
I'm not the only one.